the cheese to sit bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished. So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Tie and Expendable Underlings. Trey Dawn has actually fitted all of the Nerd and Tie network with subdermal explosives, just in case we stop making podcasts for them. Oh God, I didn't realise that before reading the copy. I'm going to go and see a doctor, but before that, I'm Charlie Etheridge-Nunn, a writer and a fan of DC's Ultra Comics, the comic slash person that may be a trap, but you're going to have to keep on reading to find out.
And I am Miles Reed-Lobato, a science fiction writer, a film of the Nicolas Cage, Charlie Kaufman film adaptation, and my terrible red shirt death was that I was killed by the Blake's boys. Yes, I was literally beaten to death by our evil alternate universe self, in a back street in Brighton with a bit of pipe.
They can't keep getting away with this, those Blake boys. My red shirt death is that I, in an ill-advised moment, picked up what I thought was a cup of coffee in a lab, and it turned out to be some kind of horrendous disease or parasite.
I mean, it could be worse. It could have been an exploding cup of coffee.
This is true. And I wouldn't think twice about it. I'd just be like, oh, yeah, that was probably my cup. And then drink it and boom.
Or like you picked up a cup of nitroglycerin.
Well, you know, if they will leave them about.
I mean, for medical reasons, I now have to carry a little vial of nitroglycerin about my person at all times, just in case my heart stops.
And then you need to hit the nose.
And I had to put it under my tongue. If my heart stops, I got to put it under my tongue. And I'll be honest, when I found out I had to carry nitroglycerin to restart my heart, part of me did go, okay, that's kind of fucking metal.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's worrying, but also rad.
Like, I'm sorry, I feel like I wish I could say that sounds like the premise of like a 2000 AD character, but I'll be honest, more likely Star-Lord.
I don't know, like early 2000 AD, you know, it's the man for Jumpstart Heart, like a really like a really early version of Crank that only lasted 10 progs, and then he blew up, you know, just like Angel and the Visible Man, like joining those ranks.
No. The man with the jumpstart heart is who they get to replace the Action Man, the host of Action Comics. Not the DC Action Comics.
No.
But the British DC Thompson Action Comics.
The one that got banned after Mary Whitehouse had a bit of an issue that one of the covers looked like a policeman was getting beaten up.
Look, Charlie, you and I both know that kids rule, okay?
This is true. This is true. Unfortunately, adults do drool.
Oh, God. Working with people much younger than me, I'm starting to get when people used to say, like, youth is wasted on the young. And now I'm starting to say it unironically, and I hate it.
Terrible. Oh, my God.
Look, I remember when I was in my early 20s, when I could stay up till like 4 a.m., get up at 6 a.m. to make it to my 9 a.m. lecture, walk to college, and finish by midday and not have a screaming mental breakdown. Now I need 8 hours of sleep a day and about 9 at night, or else I'm going to get slightly cranky.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you know who doesn't tend to get old?
God, I know this one. Keith Richards?
No. He just is in a perpetual, like, old. No. Red shirts, because they die pretty young, actually. A lot of the time. And yeah, that's my way of crowbarring in today's topic. This is an episode all about the trope of red shirts. And because we had a bit of an exciting episode last time, we figured we'd bring it right down now by talking about some Star Trek adjacent things, specifically red shirts and red shirts. But before we talk about red shirts or red shirts, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
I recently read a graphic novel, and that would be The Legend of Lufa Arkwright, written and drawn by Brian Talbot. It is the third book Brian Talbot has done concerning Lufa Arkwright, who is a multiverse-hopping secret agent slash assassin slash the next step of human evolution slash psychic Superman slash sex machine. He did the first one came out like over the course of the 70s and 80s, The Adventures of Lufa Arkwright. Then the second one, Heart of Empire, I think came out late 90s, early 2000s. And last year he finally put out a third volume. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. Brian Talbot's art is just like the very clean and pristine, which is kind of funny for someone who started drawing comics, which you sold in head shops and started off in a kind of the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers in that kind of, you know, like weed comic cross hatching, and then has evolved over time to a much cleaner art style. The book is a lot of fun. It concerns Lufa Arkwright, who is the next step of human evolution, meeting members of the next step of human evolution, who are like, yeah, we want to create a psychic utopia after we've killed every single Homo sapien in the multiverse. And Lufa Arkwright takes that personally.
Yeah, I've never read it, but he did come into the comic shop a few times, especially because that second one came out during my time working there.
I have actually met him. He was a guest at the one comic convention being held at the Hilton, and I kind of feel sorry for him, because at about 11 o'clock when he's in the hotel bar, 11 p.m., this awkward guy comes up collecting glasses and is like, I really like Lufa Arkwright. Do you know when 2000 AD is going to re-release the Gothic Empire?
Yes, actually, at the moment, I'm in the late 400s with 2000 AD, so I'm on the storyline Talk of Murder, book 6 of Nemesis the Warlock. So
is Talbot still drawing at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think this might be his last one for it, but yeah.
Yeah. I honestly do recommend the initial graphic novel, The Adventures of Lufa Arkwright. It's really good. It's very trippy and weird, but also gives us a parallel timeline where Oliver Cromwell's family continued ruling England, and so he's fighting a despotic puritanical regime in an alternate universe.
Huh?
And Prince Charles gets killed by gunfire when the revolution goes poorly.
Nice. I think Emma's got a copy. I know I've seen one floating around, and I don't own one, so it was another one of those ones where back in the comic shop days I was like, I'll get round to it. It's on the shelves. You know, like with Sandman, where I read a couple out of order because the early editions weren't numbered. And yeah, kind of left it at that.
And so, Charlie, what Star Trek thing have you been enjoying this week?
Okay, now I admit I took the piss slightly by picking a Star Trek thing, but one of the two things we're covering called Red Shirts isn't Star Trek based, so I figure I could get away with this. And I might talk about it a bit more in a dedicated episode at some point, but I downloaded the demo of Star Trek Voyager Across the Universe on the Switch 2, and then proceeded to actually buy the full game after running through the initial sector, which was Caretaker. And then I blew up Voyager twice by accident. Good work, me. And then as of yesterday, I've finished my first run all the way from the Delta Quadrant to the Alpha Quadrant. I've gone far beyond where I stopped watching Star Trek Voyager regularly, because that was season 2. And I have pockets of knowledge from casual Trek, of what some things are. So there is a Tuvix in this. But so, like, the game is a cross between a resource management fallout shelter kind of, you've got a sideways cutaway of the ship in the Elcars kind of style. You build rooms, you maintain rooms, you try and get the varied different fuels and things to try and keep the ship ticking over. You try and get morale. Like, morale was garbage in my first run, and I realized I needed to check how many people actually have quarters, because almost none of them did. And that was a mistake on my part. I grew, I learned.
I'm just imagining that Janeway's just making everyone sleep in the hallways.
Yeah, basically that. Then you've also got the space traveling kind of side, where you go through a lot of different decisions and skill checks. So my first two runs, I managed to get B'Elanna Torres split into two and keep her that way, which I, from what I've seen in Voyager, that doesn't happen in the show. I fitted the Doctor with a mobile emitter fairly early.
Wait. So you telling me that you John Crichtoned B'Elanna Torres?
Yeah. It was fine. One was a Klingon, one wasn't. One was full Klingon.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, the half Klingon, half human one was unstable without the full Klingon part of her in, but we managed to stabilize her and keep them both. The second time, sadly, both of them died. I also know it's possible to get T'Lek R'mor to stay with you, but the first time he died, and this time, like the time that I did that finished, he didn't even believe us. He was like, no, you're obviously lying, shut comms. We're like, oh fuck.
I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Tuvix, what did you do?
Gleefully killed him.
Both times?
Yes. I was very happy to destroy Tuvix. And even the, like, you get these illustrated moments when you make a big pivotal decision, and it is like, yeah, he's sent off to his death and he's all up and happy, but the rest of the crew's silence speaks volumes.
I really hope that there's an achievement you unlock for killing Tuvix.
See, I love Nintendo, I love the Switch. If there was one thing I would want them to change, I would want some kind of trophy achievement system, if only to get an achievement for killing Tuvix. We got a bunch of X-Borg and had to find ways of housing them. Seska joined the crew and stayed with the crew after the whole Cardassian face turn, although apparently once we got back, she joined the Dominion War on the other side, so, you know.
God fucking damn it.
Typical Seska. The other guy that was a traitor, we managed to talk him down, intimidate him, and kept him working for us. But he didn't get an epilogue, so who knows what happened to him.
Okay, one more question before we get on to Red
Shirt. Yeah.
Was there a Brad Dourif?
No, I didn't see Brad Dourif in it. Now, there might be one, because you get a lot of side quest things. And, I don't know. Hopefully there is one. I think they said they factored in, like, 60 or 70 episodes between 14 or 15 chapters of main stories and then lots of little side stories. So sometimes you're working on what is actually three different episodes all at once. But while you're killing time trying to build things in a workshop for the main plot, you can run over and go, oh no, we've like merged Tuvok and Neelix, or we've sent someone off and they've got trapped.
Oh no, we have to get that cheese to sickbay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We have still yet to reach that episode of Voyager.
We should do that at some point, definitely. I want to know what the hell that's about, because I've got no idea.
But yeah, I played a bit of the demo, but right now it's like, if I'm going to drop like nearly $50 in a game, it's like, do I drop it on Voyager, or do I drop it on Resident Evil Requiem? Which I kind of want to play because everyone I've seen playing it has been incredibly thirsty for Leon Kennedy.
Yes. Yeah, it does sound like that's a key feature of the game. I think it's only like 20 quid or so for each game. It's fairly cheap. I did feel like I needed to at least finish a run and maybe wait until payday before cracking and inevitably getting Pacopia, especially because I just bought Voyager Across the Universe.
Rihanna has picked up Pacopia and it's been a lot of fun from my watching it.
Yeah, I saw some early reviews going, I regret to inform you, this is very, very good. I was like, shit! No! I didn't need to know that. It will murder my time.
I don't need a Minecraft Pokemon Animal Crossing culinary cross fusion hybrid.
Yeah.
Apparently you do.
Apparently I do. Yeah. And it's got my boy Squirtle in it. So, you know.
As far as we know, my boy Wobbuffet is not in it, which is a shame because Wobbuffet is my favorite Pokemon.
Maybe in time. I would like to see that.
Right. Okay.
So, on that note, Miles, what is the first thing that we are looking at that is called Red Shirts?
It is the 5-issue IDW miniseries, Star Trek Red Shirts, which is written by Christopher Cantwell, drawn by Megan Levins, colored by Charlie Kirchhoff, and lettered by Jody Troutman.
Ah.
It is a TOS era miniseries. As you can tell from the joy in my voice, I did not enjoy this one.
Yeah. Now, I'm pretty sure Christopher Cantwell's done some all right things, but...
Christopher Cantwell is one that has been one of the main writers for the various Star Trek, some of the various main Star Trek comics done by IDW. I think he co-wrote the main Star Trek series, which we did the first volume of, Godshock.
No, Colin Kelly and Jackson Lanzig, apparently.
Okay, then, all right. Then he wrote Star Trek Defiant, the tie-in title to the Star Trek, where Worf, after getting into a fight with Sisko in Godshock, steals the Defiant and gets together a ragtag crew of ne'er-do-wells and renegades who are B'Elanna Torres, Ensign Ro, Onorion, and Spock. Worf and Spock have a fantastic relationship, despite the fact that you'd think that he'd be the two people you would not think would ever hang out.
I don't know, like, Worf, bless him, is a bit square for a Klingon. So I could see, you know, find your squarest Klingon and give him to over to the Vulcans. The Vulcans would be like, I understand this one. This one's fine. He likes prune juice.
But I think it's also because Spock and Worf are kind of outliers of their own civilizations, and so deal with that by doubling down to be the most member of their civilization. It's like, oh yeah, that's why they have so much in common. Because Spock wants to be, you know, Spock strives to be the most Vulcan, and Worf strives to be the most Klingon, even though every time he does, he immediately has to compromise his beliefs for the greater good.
Yeah, and you know, it feels often like, at least at first, he is kind of shoved into a locker by the other Klingons, who call him a big nerd, and maybe give him a bogwash.
But yeah, Defiant is a very fun comic. It's a lot of basically this group of renegades do like black ops stuff. But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so given how much you're talking about Star Trek Defiant, I can tell how much you liked Star Trek Red Shirts.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. My big issue with Star Trek Red Shirts, I mean, I have quite a few issues, all five to be exact.
Hey!
boom! is when I first heard about Lower Decks, I was kind of worried that Lower Decks was basically going to be kind of Rick and Morty Star Trek, where everything and everyone is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of that feeling in the first episode where you're like, oh, the bridge crew are completely oblivious and care not one jot about the poor bastards who do the actual work. But then it's like, after the first episode, I feel it kind of gets over that hurdle, and Lower Decks is actually a very fun show with its heart in the right place, and it manages to be an adult show, but never kind of fall into that trapping of a lot of adult cartoons where everyone and everything is terrible.
Yeah, where everyone's a jerk and nothing matters, so why do I care about these people?
Whereas, like, Star Trek Lower Decks makes you care very early on. It helps that Tendi is delightful.
Yep.
And I feel like a lot of it is down to the fact that Tendi is a ray of goddamn sunshine.
Well, Tendi and Rutherford are such a good, like, nice section to the core four. So even with the abrasiveness of Mariner and Boimler being so very, like, on edge by the book too much.
Boimler is basically what would happen if you tried to make Rimmer the protagonist of Red Dwarf and not the sitcom nemesis.
Yeah. Yeah, if you tried to make him actually likable. And, yeah, I feel you need that kind of leveling out, because in a lot of these things, you would get the guy one being the kind of Mariner wacky rogue and all of that. And yeah, there is something very nice about the comedy of Lower Decks, where it is mocking it, but with love.
Yeah. And it also helps that the worst aspects of Mariner's characterization aren't really there to be like the kind of Rick Sanchez, everything is terrible. It is to basically go, yeah, Mariner has issues, and we're basically going to see her get over the big chip on her shoulder, and it just turns out in the most Rimmer-like way that Mariner's biggest baggage is Mariner herself.
Yeah. Yeah. Which entirely tracks with that kind of person, that kind of arc. And so red shirts then.
Red shirts, okay.
Red shirts. What is red shirts about?
Red shirts is about six red shirts. I mean, sorry, not six red shirts, 12 red shirts, and we have a dramatis personae at the beginning of every issue, with ever increasing numbers of members of the team crossed out, because we have a lot in five issues, we have a lot of character death.
Right.
The main viewpoint character is Ensign Chip Miller, who is a human, age 23, because each dramatis personae has a little bio explaining what their quirk is. Because I'll be honest, none of these people are actually characters. They're quirks. They're just one note quirks, because, you know, so when they die, we can try and feel sad, but unfortunately, that never really works.
Yeah.
Ensign Chip Miller basically is a red shirt. On his first mission, he gets got by Mugato, which we see in loving detail on the first page.
Oh.
And is basically was left for dead for 8 days on this planet with half his face clawed off. He gets rescued, has scars, and is kind of bitter about it for the entire comic.
Yeah.
Because it's basically his viewpoint and his narration throughout the story. Everyone kind of thinks he's a badass because he's scarred. He got Mugato scars. But like after his first mission, the glamour of being in Starfleet has gone away immediately. And he's basically bitching internally for the rest of the comic about how he feels that red shirts are seen as inherently disposable by the rest of Starfleet.
Right.
Yeah. And so, okay. I'm gonna quickly stop. I know we've spoken on this podcast before about the Marvel comic Strike Force Moratori.
Yes.
Which is a sadly unrecognized SF comic from like the 80s or 90s of Marvel, which takes place in the future where aliens are invading Earth and select humans are given superpowers by the Moratori process, which allows them to fight back against the aliens. And all these people are made into celebrities. But there's a price catch that at some point within 2 years, you will explode and die. And there's no time limit. So at any point in the next 2 years, you can just die. And so I feel like you go through several casts of characters throughout the whole series.
Mm.
I think like in the first issue, the guy you think is going to be the main character dies like 12 pages in.
Classic.
That kind of thing. Yeah. But the thing is, because you're allowed to have time with the characters to let them breathe, and then you have that ticking clock, you're given time to actually kind of get into the heads of these characters and basically get to care about them.
Yeah. So I actually have another comparison with a Marvel comic. When you were saying about the dramatis persona and like a dozen people and crossing them off, recently, as part of my daily X-Men marathon, I decided to treat myself and read the only tangentially adjacent to X-Men, Avengers Arena, by Dennis Hallam, aka Dennis Hopeless, as he was back then. And it took, I think, 16 or 18 characters that were youths from the varied Marvel schools. So Avengers Academy, no one from the Jean Grey school, just X-23, who was off doing her own thing. It introduced the Braddock Academy and, yeah, kind of slammed them all together on an island to kill each other, because when Arcade was in prison, he read The Hunger Games and he got an idea. And by got an idea, this is Arcade. He's innovative, but he is not original. And even the series admits this. And he was like, look, I just need some wins. And if I get a bunch of kids on an island to kill each other, it'll be great. And the thing is, almost every issue has a perspective character. And it is the benefit of it being an 18-issue series. Each person, even obscure pulls from Annihilation, like Cammy, who was with Drax in the Annihilation miniseries, or again, like the Captain Britain kind of an alternate world, who's a bit of a bully and a dickhead, who is in the Braddock Academy and chafing under the 616 Captain Britain, who's his headmaster. And each of these people get a spotlight, and a lot of them die. And the thing is, you get time with them. In fact, even the things like the Battle Royale manga, which has issues. Oh my. But yeah, it lets you know all of those children.
And I will say, for about the Battle Royale manga, issues beyond the translator being a nonce.
I mean, look, no, this was Keith Giffen who has his flaws.
Oh, I thought it was the guy...
It's not Gerard Jones, no.
Okay.
No, it's Keith Giffen, who again has had accusations behaviour-wise and deceased and all that now, but he is not a nonce, unlike Gerard Jones, the other author of Justice League comics from the late 1980s. Yeah, so he was told to just take a blade to it, and added a reality show element, and just massively rewrote whole sections when he was translating it. Now, there is a newer version either come out or coming out, which is supposed to fix that and be a better translation and a kind of omnibus type thing. But like, as a series, it is very gory, very explicit. it's entertaining, and yeah, compared to the novel and the film, you get in the heads of the characters, even the obscure ones who you see for a moment and they fling themselves off a cliff. You see what led them to that cliff, and it's fascinating and tragic when you see characters and learn some depth and figure out who they are, and they die. And when it's something where it's just, here are some people, we can fudge some backstory, but you know, dead. Yeah. Like in Section 31 with the Delton, of going like, yeah, she's a thing. You know, apparently the actress had to learn all sorts of martial arts and things. Oh, dead. So what is it that's killing all of them? Is it one mission, or is it?
It's one mission.
Right.
And the thing is, like, I never thought I would read a Star Trek thing and go, now I get why you should have a Section 31. Because apparently, to do this intelligence mission, to infiltrate this obscure listening outpost on the edge of Romulan and Klingon space, you're not going to get, say, trained Black Ops operators. You're going to get a bunch of assorted red shirts. And the thing is, the idea that people who are red shirts have a life expectancy of about 6 months is brought up multiple times in the comic.
See, I don't like that being a canonical thing.
And this is where I get to one of my other big thing. The idea that people in the red shirts die is like a very amusing joke. Out of context, out of universe. But trying to either make it in-universe or explain it in-universe is like all the various retcons that the Star Wars Expanded Universe has tried to do on why stormtroopers can't shoot for shit in the films. Because there's the fundamental truth of why stormtroopers can't shoot for shit in Star Wars is because they're the bad guys.
Yeah.
Like,
it's fiction, there's a ton of them.
Yeah, Luke, Leia, and Han have to escape because they're the main characters of the story. So, yeah, you just kind of handle... I mean, okay, the first Star Wars kind of hand-waves it by going, aha, they fell for our cunning trick, which Leia sees for immediately and goes, yeah, that was too easy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you have that scene in the final season of The Mandalorian where you have the two, like, scout troopers on the bikes trying to shoot the can, and they keep missing, and it's like, yeah, that's amusing, but like, these are trained military officers. It's a funny joke, but it kind of breaks the reality because you're bringing the meta joke inside into the universe.
Yeah, I don't quite like calling out that trope in canon, especially because, like, for Star Wars, it's just background stuff, really, with the shooting. It's like, yeah, this is a high-stakes situation. With Star Trek, the red shirt thing, it feels like the way people pretend to be Kirk and having that stilting Shatner kind of thing. It's born more of the parodies.
Yeah.
When we watch the original series, when a red shirt dies, Kirk fucking goes through it.
Yeah, Kirk...
Like, a lot of the time, he knows their name. And he feels bad about it.
Yeah, and the idea that no one really cares about red shirts, about the security office, like the operations department, is just like, but this isn't borne out by anything we've seen.
No. It's just that
this is a TV show, as the novel by John Scalzi, Red Shirts, which we're going to get to after this, calls up. It's like, Yes, it's a cheap way to create drama, but that it's a TV show. You have to increase those stakes. It's like how any kind of like murder of the week show, like they kill a guy, the murder is not stopping at one because you need to have a second murder halfway through to bump up the stakes. Hell, even Agatha Christie is pointing this out in the ABC in her novel The ABC Murders, when she has a character go, you know, in a murder mystery story, sometimes a second murder can help like spice up the plot.
Yeah, like this whole, the whole kind of trope thing, suddenly making, you know, as much as the Star Trek comics are canonical, which is until anything contradicts them, which will inevitably happen. That idea of making at least semi-canonical the kind of, yeah, you know, you lost barely any time as a red shirt. Why the fuck would anyone be a red shirt? Like, you've, everyone lives in a post-scarcity world. You don't need to be a red shirt.
I get the feeling from what the comic kind of implies is that basically, that you basically get assigned red shirt detail if you don't do well in Starfleet Academy or whatever. That's basically like your remedial posting, which again makes no real sense, and it's just like, but like that seems really stupid. Like it's like, you know, people, if you're gonna have people be trained pseudo military officers, they're gonna get the best training.
Well, yeah, and we saw even with Strange New Worlds, with Uhura, and the whole kind of, like, I know that's the flagship, but even so, you get the best of the best out of an already exemplary lot. If there would be an equivalent for remedial detail, you'd just leave or be in a starbase somewhere, you know?
We have a secret covert mission into enemy space. Let's get a kickboxer, the dumbest Vulcan in Starfleet, and just a variety of characters who you would not send on a secret mission. And then send them on a secret mission. You have like 10 relatively young red shirts. The woman who's in charge of the mission, and like the contact who is already on the planet, who is the oldest red shirt at age 40. Spoiler alert, he gets killed in the second issue. I think it's meant to be shocking, because you think, oh, this is going to be like your grizzled survivalist. Like, nah, he gets his guts sliced out by an alien and then gets shot by a sniper dead.
Right.
And so they smuggle this group of people by getting them into photon torpedo cases, shooting them at the planet, planning to beam them out while they're being shot to the planet, and then fire of some actual photon torpedoes to blow up the evidence. One of the cast doesn't get beamed out in time and becomes a wall smear.
Of course.
Another one survives, gets out of the pod, and then gets blown up by the photon torpedo. And this is issue one.
Right.
And this is essentially the mission, like the mission goes south immediately. And we get to see this from Chip Miller. From his perpetually bitchy point of view, as he's complaining about how Starfleet doesn't give a fuck about red shirts and how they're seen as, like, you know, if your red shirts die, you throw more red shirts at the problem. So you perpetually get his whiny points of view as other characters around him who are more competent, who are slightly more competent and skilled than he is, because all he has to his credit is that he survived a Mugato attack and lived to tell of it.
Right.
And that's it. So for the next few fight, for rest of the story, you have the other red shirts getting killed in increasingly ignoble ways. Someone gets impaled by debris. Someone gets caught in a transporter accident and gets, you know, in Star Trek Motion Picture, when you have the two guys who are caught in the transporter accident and they get beamed back, and you hear the guy go, Enterprise, what we got back didn't live long, thank God. So we get to see a guy go, and I hate to use this term, get Cronenberged, and he probably gets phased. And it's just this ass, like, you know, because the Romulans turn up, the Klingons turn up, everyone is just kind of dying around Chip Miller, who is just kind of standing there going, God, I hate my job. God, I hate being in Starfleet. Everything sucks. Why did Starfleet send these people on this mission? And then you get to the ending,
mm-hmm.
where you find out that Chip Miller is actually a Romulan agent.
Of course.
Because when he was on the planet after the Mugatu attack, he was there for 8 days. The Romulans turned up in day three and basically gave him a job offer, to which our embittered main character goes, yeah, sure, fuck Starfleet. Like, they left me for dead on my first day because they assumed I was dead and just left me for 8 days and no point, and took that long to get back to me. At no point do they kind of give any context about why the ship may have they used to be like, oh, yep, yeah, fuck him. Like, we assume he's dead. Fuck him. Seems to be like the mindset.
So his narrative of like moaning about the job, is that him moaning about the Romulan job or still just moaning about Starfleet?
It's him moaning about Starfleet. The whole thing is because the comic ends with, it's just him and like the one surviving red shirt. They have the disc of the important information, and he shoots the other red shirt in a shock twist, the shock reveal that he was the spy all along. And the whole thing was just a great big mole hunt. And the Romulans get the information and he gets picked up by the Enterprise.
Right.
And he's just bitching the entire time.
I mean, so aside from the twist, which feels like one of those, you've already got a lot of misery, let's have another miserable thing with this twist. It feels like he was the wrong narrator, really. What you'd want is someone hopeful and excitable and like, yeah, this is going to be a great mission, and watch that.
You would want your main character to start off like, hey, you want it to be the guy who's on his first mission. And then you kind of want it to go Book of Mormon, where it's like South Africa is nothing like the Lion King. But yeah, like here is like his final bit of narration. By the time the USS Constellation picked me up, I was a true blue Romulan spy. Go figure. Starfleet had turned its back, left me for dead after I gave them everything, so I owed them nothing. It was your first day, mate. Okay, but even though I lived, maybe that's when some part of me died. But no red shirt ever really makes it anyway, right? And it's just, it's like,
I mean, how
it is that very kind of Rick and Morty, everybody sucks.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, you know, and the thing is, given the tone, I'm not sure if this is meant to be a black comedy or just what. Because, you know, if it's going to be a black comedy, and you expect, like, some kind of humor to it. But, like, when each character dies, they get pretty gruesome deaths. With the exception of the guy who gets turned into... With the exception of, like, the two who get killed in the first issue, Wallsmere and Photon Torpedo, respectively, feel very much played for laughs. But the rest of them are like, yeah, that guy gets shot, that guy gets impaled, that guy gets transporter... mutated. And it's like, yeah, all these deaths are being played for, like, as far as I can tell, serious drama. So you kind of get a very big tonal shift.
It sounds like it is glorying in the deaths. And I mean, at least from the first image that you showed me, it feels like, again, it's reveling in the kind of slapstick gore almost of it. And getting away with that, almost trying to have its cake and eat it. And yeah, this is not what I come to a Star Trek for that kind of, yeah, it's all shit in it. Look, and then it proceeds to show you how it's all
shit. It basically goes, yeah, all sides are just as bad. You know, Starfleet is just as bad as the Klingons or the Romulans, but it's not because of any deep seated, like, political, like, dubious machinations. It's just that this guy is bitter and we get his point of view from the entire comic. And then the comic does nothing to kind of either to refute his point of view. The comic starts with him going, yeah, Starfleet left me for dead. God, does that suck? And ends with, yeah, Starfleet left me for dead, so I became a Romulan spy. God, Starfleet sucks.
Great. Wow. It's
just like, what was the point? You know, like, none of the, you know, if you're going to try and make it, like, a character getting embittered, then you have that embittering throughout the story as he gets disillusioned. And then, like, you know, it, or, you know, how, like, say, I don't know, the Starship Troopers movie, where it, you know, where, you know, he starts off being where Johnny Rico starts off being relatively stupid and naive, and then by the end of the film, he's basically the Michael Ironside kind of going, "You grunts want to live forever."
God, yeah, I knew you were underwhelmed by it. When it was first discussed here, and that, I think that's where we were both a bit like, see how it plays out, and then we'll discuss it. But man, yeah,
there is a point by like issue 3 where I'm like, I don't care anymore.
Yeah,
like it's just like, you know, none of you have done nothing to make any of these characters, to make their deaths meaningful. You have given me a tiny bio. You have given me a Jonathan Hickman data page about these characters, but no, there's nothing here to actually make me like the characters. Like, Lieutenant Webster Cromarty, longest serving security officer in Starfleet, Klingon War veteran, descendant of Maine lumberjacks, field ribbons, 4, Starcross, decoration, survivalist, loner. He's the one who's dead by issue 2. And it's like, yeah, he's a cliche and you don't give me anything to go on. Lieutenant Salgado Amiga. Okay, the fact that the guy's name is Amiga was very amusing to a Brit.
Yep.
Hails from West Texas. Hopefully he's not a member of the best ever death metal band in West Denton in West Texas. Klingon war veteran aboard the USS Laval. Starcross decoration. The nicest guy in Starfleet according to Leonard McCoy. That's nothing.
Yeah.
Like, none of, like, it's like, great. You have little bits of, like, their hobbies and interests in their careers. That's nothing for me to care about.
So, like, the red tops are primarily, in the original series era, tactical and engineering, security, that kind of thing. So, are these, like, security ensigns, or are they their own, like, are red shirts a thing, like an official thing in this?
As far as I can tell,
like 20 minutes,
they're basically security.
Okay.
They just, and you know, gets, they get posted, and you know, Vulcan Ensign Borvik, Vulcan male, rejected from Vulcan Science Academy, settled for Starfleet Academy, questions authority, chose security to place himself in the upper tier of intelligence among his peers. Now, okay, that's pretty interesting. He's dead by issue 3.
Of course.
Of course. It's just like, you know, you can have a team of cliches, but, you know, like Predator or Aliens, it's like, you can have a team of cliches who have a lifespan of like 2 hours, but you can do stuff to make me care.
Man, as a kid, right, with Aliens, not only were there the Kenner action figures, but I used Warhammer paints to paint other toys to look like the characters that they didn't have Kenner, like, versions of. And the headcanons my brother and I and some of our friends would come up with about all of them based on the film and bits of reading the Alan Dean Foster adaptation, and they came alive as characters in admittedly a very localized fashion, but from that film all of that sprung out. And yeah, like, again, with Battle Royale, you see a lot of different characters. Like, I love Battle Royale, Avengers Arena, really enjoyed Squid Game. Like, I ran an RPG called Deathmatch Island. This kind of, you've got a big cast and you start whittling away. It's a good premise. It's a fine thing.
It's like one of the strengths of Doctor Who, of some Doctor Who writers, both classic and modern, is that you have, since you have like, you have a new location, new cast of characters every 4 to 6 weeks. You can develop your supporting characters. So when they get killed by a Dalek, you actually care. I mean, like, that's one of the strengths, I'd say, of Russell T. Davies' era of Doctor Who, is that like you could have Rose meet like someone who just cleans the space windows on a space station. Rose can have like a 3 minute conversation in where we get a picture of who this person is, wants to be, and who they are, and then they let them get melted 2 minutes later and you cry.
Yeah.
Because like you can get these side characters who would just be like the spear chuckers or the Oserans and just go, yeah. Like they're blue, but like they have a job and they have a personality, and it gives them a little bit of life so that when they die, which they inevitably do, it's Doctor Who, you're like, man, that was actually kind of really sad.
Yeah.
And it's just, you can do this kind of story, but if you're basically going to go into it, basically presenting all of your characters as very thin one-note characterizations, and then just letting the small amount of info we get in their data file do the carrying, then like you've got nothing. It's like the Transformers, like the old cartoon. It's like all the various Transformers have some kind of character tick, so they stand out, which then means you can sell the toys. But that, and also when they did the Transformers movie in the 80s, when they got rid of the toys to introduce the new toys and had them get killed off, it's like, shit, you killed Ironhide. I somehow feel strongly about the death of Ironhide, who was basically the tough, grizzled Southern Autobot. And then when you had like the 2007 live action Transformers movie and Megatron kills Jazz, you're like, I only cared that you killed Jazz because I remember how cool Jazz was in the cartoon back in 1984, and here in the movie he just kind of speaks like how Michael Bay thinks non-white people speak, and then they get told apart. Just like, that's you gave me nothing to work with, you just gave me a name, and then you expected nostalgia to do the rest.
Yeah, which is very unfortunate with that kind of thing. Right.
Or like, Lost. Ernst. They brought in the character.
I loved Mr. Ernst.
Ernst is great because he's just he turns up, he is unpleasant from the get-go. He makes fun of everything in the show thus far and then gets blown up talking about the dangers of unstable nitroglycerin, and it's great, and that's how you make a side character's death both be entertaining, really strike a chord, and then also, hey, you got Ernst on you. It's like when I was watching it with Rihanna, she hated Ernst. I mean, it's like, just wait, he's gonna get his in about 5 minutes and it's gonna be great.
And he was there for what, 3 episodes, I think. Yeah. Something like that, just to go set up payoff. There you go.
Set up, make fun of the fact that you have like 6 people who know everything that's going on, who keep going off on secret missions, and there is this whole weird side SF shit going on over there.
Yeah. So, right. I have an idea of how you would fix this premise.
Okay.
Okay, so what we're going to do is, we don't want to say all of Starfleet is like this. Again, they are the 20-minuters. Somehow, there are no heads of security in this era because they all these people only last for a few months.
Or basic intelligence operatives.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, from what I gather, Enterprise ends with some Section 31 hints from Reed and all that. So there is an intelligence and a shady intelligence kind of thing. But with this, what you need to do is localize it. Have Chip or have some guy in charge, either a captain or a head of security, who calls his people red shirts. And there, if you really need to canonize the trope somehow, it's this one guy that is a nut job, and yet somehow, because he gets results from the throwing wave after wave of men, Zap Brannigan style, then yeah, you get someone on his first day going, oh, this is great, and oh, it's not.
You basically have a bad moral.
Yeah.
You have someone be a bad moral. Mm. And, you know, which should be a term canonized in Star Trek. And like, yeah, you essentially have like, no, not like Zap Brannigan, but like Melchett in go full 20 minutes. Have like a Starfleet officer who is basically played by Stephen Fry in full on meh mode. Like give him the tash.
Yeah.
Like give him a swagger stick. Like make this guy a militaristic douchebag.
Well, yeah. And then if you really need that the Romulan spy, give him a second in command that is helping him, making nice suggestions, you know, flatter the ego, help provide for misinformation, and oh, that's a Romulan who's encouraged this guy that really should have retired a long time ago into reliving his Klingon war fantasies and how he used to push little starships on a map using a, I don't know, like hollow pointer or whatever.
Yeah. And then also you just put it into, it's like the grand old Star Trek cliche of the Enterprise is the only ship in the sector when the important thing is happening. You don't just gather together a bunch of barely trained people and throw them at an important mission. It's just like, well, shit, we can't, you know, we're the only ship in the sector. It's going to take time for us to call Starfleet and for Starfleet to send a crew of operatives. This is who we've got. And this is who we've got to work with.
Yeah, yeah. We're desperate. We need to do this. These guys are rookies. They're just red shirts. Send them down and have that desperate battle for survival.
It's like, yeah, it sucks, but they're the guys. It's like they signed up. They know what the job. They know what the job entails. And sadly, they're the guys who have got to do the job in their first month. And like in their first month, it's do or die time.
Yeah. There you go. There, we've fixed it for you.
Yeah, and it's just...
And, like, you could even go, right, at the very end, we have the Enterprise show up, and one, maybe two red shirt that's, you know, kind of traumatized, horrified by it all, and go, ah, we found out Romulan spy, all of that, this guy, Admiral, off to jail, spy, off to jail. We don't worry, we've rescued you. It's like, did we do good? So
and then ends with like your comedy stinger of him now having to go to the exploding rock planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And like you said, when a red shirt dies in classic Trek, Kirk is pissed.
Yeah.
Like Kirk is like, shit, I went to his kid's bar mitzvah.
Exactly. Exactly. Like the times we saw that, I was so surprised because I've been so primed by this kind of trope. And it's become, you know, like a Flanderized trope almost. It's become so accentuated, so distilled into, oh yeah, anyone that's a red shirt dies, to the level of changing their shirt color. And it's like, well, yeah, but somehow even more of them die under like the TNG era onwards and a lot more namelessly as well, which... Yeah, feels callous compared to Kirk going, oh my god, oh no, I was at his wedding.
Oh
fuck.
Oh man, Jenkins got God. I never thought Jenkins would get God. Not Lenny. Oh.
We were gonna play tennis later.
Like, shit. Wait, Wait, Lenny died? He owed me 20 credits. I know we live in a moneyless society, but he owed me 20 quid.
Wow. Okay, so do we know how well or badly this did?
I don't know. Like, it's a mainstream Western comic put out by IDW. So I'm sure it did well, but not as good as comics did back in the 90s. It's like, how well do most X titles sell these days?
Yeah. It's difficult trying to get sales figures for any of this kind of stuff these days. Yeah.
It's like, I'm sure Star Trek has an audience, but for the comics, but it's mostly going to be Star Trek fans.
Yeah.
And people who ended up getting this on their pull list, like I did when Star Trek and Defiant ended. Like, somehow when Star Trek ended, red shirts got folded into my pull list, which then became The Last Starship, which is a much better comic, though still has a moment when Kirk gets called out for the amount of people who got killed under his command. And it's just like, yeah, but it's a TV show. It's a TV show. B, they're out in space, and they're usually the one lone guy who's doing it. If you try to explain why all these people keep dying, yeah, in real life, it would definitely be Kirk is going to get put on trial for basic competence. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, no one goes down to a planet expecting land shark.
No, I mean, how could you? Like, we know that space is full of eldritch horror kind of things in Star Trek, where you go like, they just flew into the wrong bit of space. Yeah. Figured they would scan an anomaly. Now they've all gone inside out.
Yeah.
Like, space is horrifying like that.
It's like, what happened to this guy? Oh, we ran into a giant face who's made his heart explode.
Mm.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look at Zero. Like, their whole species drives people insane to look at them. Like, space is terrifying and deadly. If you want to do terrifying and deadly in Star Trek, you can do terrifying and deadly. It just, you know, make it have a point.
Yeah. So, shall we talk about the second red shirt on our menu today?
Let's. So, The Other Red Shirts is a novel by John Scalzi, someone I've been aware of for many years, and yet somehow this is the only book by him I've read, and only when you suggested it.
I honestly do recommend, like, John Scalzi is one of the few writers who, when he puts out a book, I tend to grab it immediately, because he does mostly kind of like, he has two different avenues of books. He either does like proper science fiction, be it like either space opera, like his Interdependency trilogy, or military SF, like his Old Man's War series of books. And then he has his more comedic novels, of which this is definitely one of.
So this was what, released 2012, 5th of June 2012, published by Tor Books. And it's an interesting one. While it goes into some of the terrain that Star Trek Red Shirts has, it does some quite different things. Not necessarily things I expected, and I don't know entirely how I stand with an amount of it.
That is completely fair. What this does have that Star Trek Red Shirts does not have is its own title song, performed and sung by Jonathan Colton, who gave us all Still Alive, the closing song for the amazing video game Portal.
Of course. Huh. I didn't realize he had his own, like, it had its own theme by him.
But yeah, this book is about a bunch of red shirts who get posted to the Universal Union capital ship Intrepid, crewed by a collection of people who suspiciously seem like XPs of the original Star Trek cast. You have the very melodramatic Captain Abernathy. You have an alien science officer who seems to be very kind of emotionally or logically driven, called King. And amusingly for me, the ship's doctor is called Hartnell.
Yep. Yeah. I thought you'd appreciate that.
And so you have this collection of characters who seem to realize that whenever they get sent on missions, their death is much more likely to happen. But also, things don't seem to work in a normal way on their ship. Like, a bunch of them work in the science department, and they have something called the box, which is like essentially a magic box that whatever kind of scientific thing is going to happen, they have to put the sample in this box, wait for it to spit out a cure, and then they have to deliver it to the bridge personally, and then go, here's the thing, we had a problem with the protein strings, so the science officer could solve it. And they start to realize, or one of the crew, who is a hairy man who lives in the air ducts, is that they might be living in a TV show, and that their lives are controlled by what they refer to as the narrative, which is this omnipresent kind of force which controls everything around them. And for spoilers of a novel put out in 2012 on this Star Trek podcast, they find out that they are essentially in this universe, which is a TV show made in 2012 called Chronicles of the Intrepid, which even in the world of the book is a terrible knockoff of Star Trek. Star Trek itself gets referenced in the actual book, and they basically say, yeah, this series, Chronicles of the Intrepid, is just a terrible knockoff of this much better show. So they realize that they can travel back in time to the real universe to kind of go, hey, your stories are actually killing us up in the future. Can you do something about that? And so it goes in a much more meta direction than I was expecting. I originally listened to the audiobook when I first read this book back in 2012, which is read by Will, the boy Wheaton.
Wow. Yeah, this feels entirely up his alley as something he'd do an audiobook of.
And he does a good job. Will Wheaton is a very good audiobook narrator.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, God, I forget what it was, but there were some readings of his Star Trek Memories from the Future on something. And yeah, he's a good orator for that sort of thing. Yeah, so given everything you've described, right, you have mentioned some of the bridge crew level people and a guy who lives in events, and something I came out of it a bit kind of, yeah, like, you've mentioned the plot but not the characters of it, and it feels like the characters feel a bit like that, you know. They do have some traits, some of them, not much.
They basically have one note, like the characters of Red Shirts, the comic, they basically have one note characterizations. So,
and for some of them, that is very much by design.
Yes.
Mm.
Like, it is basically like, even the plot goes, yeah, we basically have the barest minimum of characterization until it gets important to the narrative that we are important, so that when we die, the death matters to make the plot work.
Yeah, like the very introduction, the very start of it does have a red shirt who isn't one of the main characters and does die. And yeah, I wasn't sure where I stood with that. I was like, okay, you're setting the tone a bit. And then we get, what is it, Andrew Dahl, Maya Deval, James Hansen IV, and Hester, who is just Hester for the majority of it, who are kind of main ensigns. There's also Finn, but red shirt lifespan kind of happens there. And it's that thing of when they start piecing together that something is up, I thought it would be something in universe, whether yeah. it is a kind of the bridge crew are aware or have affected probability or fortune or something to kind of have the red shirts die instead of them, because a lot of the time it is made that kind of this person sacrificed themselves for me, or you get who was it, Anatoly Kerensky, who is the tactical guy who keeps getting beaten up.
I think he was one of my favorite characters because it's like, because he's basically the Chekhov, and he yeah. exists to be the one of the main characters who has bad things happen to him, but not to the point of nearly dying. But
yeah.
Yeah. So
like, he heals quickly because in a week's time there's going to be another problem. But yeah, he's going to get almost killed. I guess in a way there's also a little bit of that wharf to him.
Yeah.
Of, as the tactical guy, he's going to do security stuff. He's got a bunch of red shirts around him, and he's going to only mostly die to set the stakes for the problem. Compared to the Doctor, who, if you're going with the Doctor, you're fucking dead.
Yeah. Or like they have things on their phones, so they know that when someone is coming to leave the room to get coffee, so they don't get sent on the mission.
Yeah, the science guys pretty quickly have learnt to avoid away missions, and I think it's Dahl figures out, kind of finds out, oh, this is why they vanish and go to a different room just to move boxes. And again, to do background extra stuff,
yeah,
rather than actually get called forward. And that dual thing of, do we insinuate ourselves with the upper deckers in order to be there, but hopefully by proximity not die? Or do we disentangle ourselves from it and just hide? And where you got your air vent man and stuff like that, and people like Hester, are people who, in the reality where it's a TV show, like he appeared and the actor was in a coma, and while they didn't die, nothing was established. So just a day player and the son of Charles Paulson, the head producer of the show. And as such, Hester does have a full name, but is only known as Hester because the narrative has kind of bent around and doesn't pay attention to them, because the TV show won't, because it's in a coma.
Yeah, and then you have Jenkins, Air Vent Man, whose wife, who was an extra, died in an earlier episode, and he just existed to be sad about this other character dying, and so he has nothing to do but go off the rails and go crazy.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, it's that kind of extrapolation of what happens to these people. It's like Balance of Terror, when you have the two who are going to get married at the start of the episode, and then the groom dies, and then it ends with Kirk consoling like his widow, the guy's widow, essentially at the end of the episode. Like, what happens to this person who in the realm of the show, we're going to forget about immediately because the story has no use for them. But what happens to them? Like they now have to rebuild their life after having it cruelly torn apart for like a, wow, wasn't that sad moment at the end of the episode.
Yeah, like, it's an interesting thought experiment with a lot of this. I did find myself at some points picking it back up with some of it, especially because, yeah, when they were like, oh, but what if this is a really shit TV show and we need to travel into reality and do all that? It's like, I remember messaging you going, if John Scalzi appears in this, I'm throwing the book away. Like, I am done with this book if the author shows up. And luckily he didn't. But especially because this was on my Kindle, so I really should stop throwing my Kindle when there's a terrible book.
How many Kindles have you gone through now?
Like, I think I'm on my third.
Okay, fantastic.
So yeah, it's not too bad. Yeah, yeah, I tend to buy cheap secondhand ones because I don't need any of the fancy bells and whistles. I need the distractions taken away.
Yes.
Because my attention span is garbage.
On the whole, I enjoyed it. I think I enjoy this book more than you. I do think that there is a problem, which is the same problem that I'd say Joss Whedon has, in which a lot of his characters basically, they're less characters and more people having the same level of sense of the same level of intelligence and sense of humor, bouncing one-liners off each other.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
As I've said, like, I've read a good chunk of his books, and I honestly, as an SF writer, I do recommend him. And like, maybe just be like, this one wasn't for you. And I feel like the book treats the concept of characters who exist only to get killed 10 minutes into a TV show with a lot more gravitas and drama and sometimes comedy than Red Shirts the comic did. I loved the idea that commercial breaks happen, and when they happen, like, the main characters just stop being melodramatic for a second. Like, there's a great part when, like,
chill out a bit.
Whenever Abernathy gets into a commercial break after he's done, like, a very important bit of dramatic narration, he just kind of goes, man, this is kind of weird, right? Right?
I mean, so, yes, like, there are some fun bits, although the "this is kind of weird, right?" feels very much like, this is what, 2012, so at this point Joss Whedon's doing the Avengers. He's not yet been outed as a bit of a scumbag. You've got a lot of that early MCU kind of, hey, that thing just happened kind of humor, which is still very prevalent.
You've got that very kind of postmodern, the characters are all kind of subtly aware they're in a TV show, but not really. Which is always kind of annoying, because it's like when you have people, when people online go, oh, well, if I was in a horror movie, I wouldn't do that, which hits its nadir in the section with an episode of Community where we get to see Abed's horror movie, which would be the worst horror movie ever, because Abed, who is genre savvy, just goes, okay, we're just going to turn our phones on, call the police, and stay in this one room. And as someone who likes the film Scream, it's like, first of all, no one ever, you know, if you spend your life going, this is a horror movie, like, your life must be horrendous, because, you know, it is that just kind of very obnoxious, well, I wouldn't do that. It's like, yeah, but no one ever wakes up going, I think I'm like, if I went to a cabin with, like, a bunch of my mates in the woods, at no point will I be thinking, well, an undead psychopath with a machete and a hockey mask is clearly going to come gunning for us. First of all, because I know which horror movie slasher movie cliche I am, I'm the fat comic relief guy, so I'm dying, like, after the couple who have sex, and before the square-jawed male love interest who gets killed just before the final girl goes on a kill rampage.
Yeah, yeah, hard saying, you know? Fat guy who is far too genre-aware, and, yeah, maybe either second or fourth dead.
Yeah, it's like, even in the film, like, you know, the film Scream, it's like, when Randy is going over the rules of how to survive a horror movie, it's everyone's making fun of him while he's doing it, and B, while he's talking about how you should never drink or do drugs and to survive a horror movie, he is very noticeably holding a beer.
Well, yeah, everyone is.
Everyone is, because, like, they're teenagers. You don't think, oh shit, I'm in a slasher movie.
No, and that's, yeah, I think some of the genre savviness felt a little too, like,
2012.
Yeah, a little too on the nose. I hadn't realized it was 2012 that it was written, but this feels exactly like pinpoint that period in time. We're not quite at the Ready Player One kind of horrors and the shit. Like, we're not at the point where people went, oh yeah, Ready Player One's really good, and not, fuck man, this is almost predicting the level of crossover slop that your Funkos and all that bullshit has. But it's like, it's fine. I remember I was describing it to Emma and she said, like, do you know what he was, like, he did work on TV. I was like, okay. And she said, guess what? Guess which show he did. I was like, any hints? It's like, what did you say about Red Shirt? So I was like, it's fine. She was like, yeah, that is a TV show. And I was like, Stargate? It's like, yes.
Well, he did Stargate Universe, which is a much less red shirty show than Stargate SG-1, because you have a core cat, you have a core cast stuck on a spaceship on the fucking arse end of the galaxy. So you have your, you have that Voyager BSG issue of, we have a very limited core cast.
Yeah, and a little bit lost in space in some ways. Like, a bunch of the early episodes were named after whatever resource they were running out of that week. Like, I enjoyed Universe vastly more than SG-1.
I honestly,
I never bothered with Atlantis.
I've seen a handful of episodes of SG-1, and I watched a good chunk of Stargate Universe, which I honestly enjoyed. It's like, I know it kind of got made fun of because it was trying to be like the young teen sexy Stargate, but I was like, this is actually a very good show with like some very interesting ideas. And I'll be honest, Robert Carlyle is magnificent.
He's so good.
Like,
up there with Dr. Zachary Smith, my role model.
Like, he is bumping the quality of the material up a good percentage of the time. And it's like, yeah, it's a good show. It just never got that. I feel like it got abandoned by the core Stargate, like the core Stargate fan base, who got annoyed that it wasn't a military team on a starship.
Nah.
And I'm like, nah. Sorry, I'm British. I like my alien fighting military to be a bunch of like weird squaddies in a porter cabin in the North Countries, like in 70s Doctor Who.
Yeah, like any of those kind of things, I've never much for a fan of like, yeah, what if Star Trek, but we're only ever going to do desert or Vancouver and militarism. We will do science or militarism, but we know one of these looks more exciting, so you know what we're going for.
And that's why you and I both prefer Space 1999, where everything is weird and terrifying, and it's a bunch of office managers called upon to be space heroes.
Yeah, and people get the tea in.
Yeah, and like, they meet a lot of alien cultures which have installed breeding programs, and yeah.
Every time. It's like, yeah, with this really advanced civilization, it's like, go on. Yeah, we've discovered all this wonderful technology. Yes. And it involves eugenics. Fuck. Guys, not again.
We need to do a Space Camps 3.
We do. We should go back to that. I've missed it. I still need to read the role-playing game of it, which I know there is an ability, which is if you get a round of tea in for everyone. And then it's like, I know that, like the Jane Austen RPG Good Society, it's going to be spoiled on my lovely role-playing group who, like, one of them saw a couple of Jane Austen adaptations because Emma and I forced him to, and no one else had any knowledge. Space 1999 will have even fewer people aware of what the fuck this is.
So I think at this point we have kind of, you know, reached the natural end of our discussion. It's like,
yeah, we're distracting ourselves by talking about Stargate and Space 99.
I honestly recommend most novels by John Scalzi. I do recommend Old Man's War, which is military SF in the kind of Starship Troopers tradition, but there are some interesting twists on it.
But good then.
And also just less advocating for like far-right militaristic fascism.
Oh, good. I'd rather not have any of that.
Like, the codependency trilogy has a very interesting high concept idea, which is this entire galaxy-spanning empire is connected by all these naturally occurring wormholes. And the reason it's called the dependence, codependency, is that they need all the various planets to get resources from some planets to other planets. So, like, food-producing planets produce food for non-food-producing planets. And then what happens when these naturally occurring wormholes start to shift because of the nature of space? And so you have, as the first book is called, a collapsing empire. It's like, what do you do when you're trying to basically sort out resources for your empire? You know this thing is happening. Do you alert the people who are going to get isolated for another 1,000 years? Or do you just let things go on and just try and save yourself?
Right. Yeah, like, I wouldn't say it was wasted time reading this. I think Red Shirts, the novel, had a lot of entertaining things. I just... When I have my metafiction, I kind of prefer things like Ultra Comics and Annihilator by Grant Morrison, which felt there was a bit more about it than let's unpack this trope. Yeah. And, you know, it's fine.
I mean, it's definitely, I'll say it's better than the comic because I read both pretty concurrently. And it's like, you know, for all of Red Shirts, the book's flippancy, I feel like there are attempts to have like some emotional core to the book. I feel the book is more of a lead up to like the three separate codas, which unpacks what happens to the people in the real world that they meet. And so I feel like there is more resonance, emotional resonance, than Red Shirts, the comic, which just kind of goes to, man, everything sucks. Even the good guys suck. What's the point of it all? And it's just like, yeah, guys, can we, you know, like, it's 2026. Can we kind of stop with this mindset of everything sucks? Or all sides suck, there's no point.
So, one last thing. I have an other media list that I've got here of Star Trek Debt of Honor in the number one spot and William Shatner's The Transformed Man in the number two spot. Would you put Star Trek Red Shirts above or below The Transformed Man on our list of apocrypha?
I think we both know the answer.
Yeah, very much.
And the answer is Mr. Tambourine Man!
I had to stop myself from laughing mid-dental surgery when I heard the original Mr. Tambourine Man being played during a root canal. That was a weird, weird moment. And not one I could explain to the people of, like, why are you going odd for a moment?
I think when I had a root canal a few years ago, the dentist I went to had, like, a TV set into the ceiling. So while they're doing dental work, you can pop onto headphones and watch Netflix. And this was back when Star Trek was on Netflix. So I was watching Way of the Warrior, Deep Space Nine, Season 4, Episode 1, while having a root canal.
Oh my god. Wow. They had a TV that was off, so I was doing my best not to make eye contact with myself, my reflection, and whatever was going on in my mouth at the time. Instead, I was fixedly looking at a... like Giles level cartoon of like a golf scene of a bunch of characters on like one panel of false ceiling. And it's faded, it's old, but it's literally all that was keeping me from accidentally looking down and seeing more bloody implements being taken out of my mouth.
I feel there is some metaphor for the difference between the British and American dental systems here.
Yeah, probably.
And okay, on that note,
yeah, we'll leave the audience to ponder that themselves. So yeah, because we were talking about Red Shirts this time, next time we're going to see if we can find some different episodes representative of the Red Shirt phenomenon in each of the Star Treks. And until then, where can they find us?
They can find me on my Blue Sky at marsreedlabato.bsky.social. They can find us on our Casual Trek Blue Sky account when someone remembers to access it on casualtrek.bsky.social. They can find me on my blog at mareedlabato.wordpress.com or the Endless Bookshelf on my YouTube channel. And Charlie, where can the folks find you?
They can find me on skyshark.itch.io. That's both the website that hosts the varied comic and RPG things that I put together and my Blue Sky handle, where I mostly talk about X-Men, but occasionally I revel in the horrible things that I've been doing during Star Trek Voyager Across the Universe. Also on Fate Tales, I have blog posts, which I hopefully will have actually put up by the time this airs. Other than that, you can also buy us a Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/casualtrek. Sling us some bars of gold pressed latinum, suggest a theme, a topic, a mood, a color, anything, and we will try and build an episode of Casual Trek based around it. I guess the theme for next time is red. And with that, go do a Starfleet.
And watch out for landworms.
Yeah, and big rocks.
Exploding stuff that explodes.
Transporter accidents.
The color mauve.
Those Blake's Boys versions of us.
Morris dancers. Definitely watch out for Morris dancers.
Definitely Morris dancers. They are the worst.
They're all evil.
Terrible creatures.
They know what they did.
They do. Oh, that jingling. Oh, when you can hear it coming, just run.
Oh no, Charlie. I can hear the jingling of Morris dancers. In Wisconsin. I think they found me.
Finally, they've found you after all these years.
Run, Charlie. Save yourself.
You've been listening to Casual Trek by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Labato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Casual Trek's part of the Nerd and Tie Network. And if you want to support us monetarily because you love what we do that much, you can now do that by going to Ko-fi and looking up Casual Trek. There's a link in the show notes.